You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and Meatopia, the premier food event of the season, celebrating our meat suppliers, farmers, and butchers at Brooklyn Bridge Park, July 23rd. Watch a dozen Whole Foods Market butchers from across the country compete on stage for the title of Best Butcher. Visit www.meatopia.org for tickets and information.
Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And, sorry, I'm a little hoarse tonight. So I've been away for a couple weeks. If you're a regular listener, you may have noticed that we played some of the best ofs, or I hope we did, of the show while I was away. But I'm back now. I'm back for the long haul. So I was away on, first I was on vacation, and then I was away for work. And I went to Arizona with my niece, my 11 and a half year old niece. And then I was in Ohio for a food and wine festival that I do every year. And I was gone basically for 2 weeks with one day in between. And my husband was hardly home for those 2 weeks either because he was up in tiny bungalow land. So I came back Sunday night. We came back because he was in Ohio with me. And we had an empty fridge. There was nothing, no food. Nothing. But we eat a lot of beans, so it's okay, because there were cans of beans around, so we ate beans. But then I said, we have to go shopping. So this morning, I went and checked on my bees, because I have not visited my bees in about 3 weeks. And they're fine. They're good. They're making honey. They're doing what they're supposed to do. But then I went to the farmer's market. I went to just the little one at Borough Hall in Brooklyn. And, you know, there's the usual stuff, and I'm walking around. And there was sweet corn there, big pile of corn. And I thought, wow, really? This early in the summer? And then I realized that it's, what, July, what's today? The 19th, 20th? Suddenly, somehow, it's the end of July. Like, basically, the summer's over. So it makes sense that there was corn there. I left town on July 5th. I still think it's July 5th. I still think, oh, summer's just starting. But nope, it's almost over. So, of course, it's corn season. And, you know, we're coming into the whole tomato, eggplant, zucchini barrage time. But when I was out in Arizona 2 weeks ago, the corn was already in season out there. Everything was, like, everything's earlier. They had peaches and corn and tomatoes. We went blackberry picking. It was nice. And I'm always surprised when I see sweet corn for sale in places like that, which is stupid because corn comes from Central and South America and the Southwest. But I think of sweet corn as such a like archetype of the Northeast, which doesn't make any sense. But I guess because I grew up here and I have this thing about it, I think it's like an East Coast thing, and that in the Southwest they only eat field corn, which is the stuff that, you know, gets ground up into masa and tortillas and cornmeal and all of that. But it was there. They were eating it. You know, if you're going to grow field corn, you're going to grow sweet corn. One's just a genetic mutation of the other. And I suppose that everything is grown everywhere now, really, except citrus in the Northeast. We haven't managed to figure that one out yet. And that's what, like, people who live in citrus-growing climates, of course, they take it for granted. But for being from New York, I get so excited when I see oranges on a tree. It seems so foreign and exotic to me. Like, oh my God, there are oranges on that tree. When we were in Phoenix, my niece and I saw an orange tree on someone's front lawn, and I pulled over so she could run out and jump up and grab some off of their tree because it was so exciting. But anyway, I was in Arizona because I wanted to take my niece to the Grand Canyon. And also, an old friend of my sister's lives in Flagstaff. She's a botanist at NAU there, and I haven't seen her in about 15 years, and she had invited my niece to come and visit her, but she's too young to go by herself. So I went with her. And I've been out there before, a couple of years ago. And I'm always completely taken by the way that the landscape there changes. You know, you land in Phoenix and it's totally flat and covered in these crazy looking cacti and saguaro, and you feel like you're on another planet, you know, coming from the leafy east. And then you start driving and you leave and you start driving and you climb 7,000 feet between Phoenix and Flagstaff, and it's only 150 miles. And you go from this like piney, crazy, it looks sort of like Dr. Seuss land out there, up to this like leafy, piney, green kind of lush place, except they're having a drought and it's the dry season. But well, now it's the wet season. It happened while we were there. But it's such a cool drive, like that shift in terroir, that shift in climactic zones that occurs 150 miles. It's like going from like, I don't know, Mars to Jupiter or something. But anyway, we were both really taken by it, even though I've seen it before. And the rental car had a thermometer that, you know, gave you the outside temperature. And when we left Phoenix, it was 106. And when we got to Flagstaff, it was 79. We were so excited. We jumped out of the car, shut off the air conditioning. But we had spent that first night in Phoenix because I wanted to take my niece to the Desert Botanical Garden there. There's not that much else to see in Phoenix, but that Desert Botanical Garden is amazing. They have this massive collection of cactus plants and desert plants, and she's really into plants, so she really liked it. It was really cool. But we went at 7 o'clock in the morning because it gets so hot there in summer. And so because we wanted to go early that morning, we got in the day before, so we found this very cool hotel that it's called the Clarendon. If you're in Phoenix, I'm giving them a little plug. And they had a restaurant in the hotel called Gallo Blanco. And I had read about it online, and it sounded really good. People were saying it was great Mexican. So we ate there because we didn't want to. It was too hot to go driving around. And also, we wanted to get up early. So decided to eat there after basically spending the whole afternoon at the pool because it was, you know, 100 and whatever that afternoon. And it's a good thing that we ate at the hotel because as we were sitting there eating, that gigantic dust storm blew in. That was the night we were there. The haboob, apparently they are called haboobs, these giant dust storms, blew in. And we were sitting in a restaurant with plate glass windows. So we watched the whole thing, and the whole city just disappeared. It was like a brown blizzard. Like a blizzard came in, but it was dirt. It was really crazy. But we were inside, happily sitting, drinking IPA. Well, I was drinking IPAs. She was drinking water. And we were eating some of the best tacos that I've ever had. Now, soft tacos, the real thing, not, you know, old El Paso taco in the box kit that I grew up eating on Long Island. Real tacos, like the soft kind, in soft corn tortillas. And it was taco night there, so you could get like 3 for the price of 2. So, of course, we ate like 9. And that dust storm was crazy and fascinating. But the tacos were so good, I sort of couldn't even pay attention to it. And on the flight in, I had been talking to her about, you know, the strong Mexican influence. Obviously, you're very close to the Mexican border there. But, you know, explaining to her how, you know, basically that whole part of the country really was Latin America up until not that long ago. And, you know, before the Spanish culture, it was Native American. And I was sort of explaining to her, you know, the layers of culture in that part of the country and how the food reflected it and how in Phoenix you could get, you know, really excellent Mexican food. But as we, and also Native American influence, but as we, you know, headed further north, she would see less Mexican and more Native American. And so I was talking to her about it, and she was, you know, pretending to be interested because she's a nice, polite child and indulges me. But then at dinner, you know, they brought out these soft tacos, and I think she really got it because they were, you know, the fillings were great. There was like a veg one and a, you know, carne asada and all that. But what I wanted her to really experience was the fresh corn tortillas because, you know, we all eat this kind of stuff all the time, you know, in other places. But to get like really fresh, really good corn tortillas is like a really special thing. That like roasty kind of smell and like the dampness of them, I think, is an amazing thing. She had never had such good ones before, so these were great. They didn't disappoint. So if you're ever in Phoenix, Gallo Gallo Blanco, I think it's called, in the Clarendon Hotel. Loved it. And they were probably making them either right there or they had bought them from somebody really good. I mean, these were exceptionally good tortillas. So we were kind of on this like taco fix thing. We were, or at least I was a little obsessed. So the next morning we went to that botanical garden. And then I looked online to find a farmer's market because that's what I like to do when I'm in a new city. And the only one I could find was sort of an indoor little market. It gets so hot there in the summer that they have the farmer's market in the late afternoon, and we were leaving. But I asked the guy in the market where he likes to eat tacos, and he said, oh, well, do you have a car? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you have to go to this place called America's Taco Shop. And I was like, really? America's Taco Shop? But apparently it's owned by someone named America, so that's okay. So we went to this place, and it was this, you know, just little, not really all takeout, but you know, some tables, not too high end, kind of cool place. And we had these, again, like incredibly good tacos made with really great tortillas, really fresh. And they had carnitas, you know, like good cooked pork and carne asada. And we also had elote, which is Mexican corn. So it's an ear of sweet corn. You probably had it. You probably know what I'm talking about. It's an ear of sweet corn that gets like slathered with mayo and chili powder or like chipotle powder. And then also kind of smothered in grated queso añejo, the grated cheese. And it's a really, really good combination when the corn is good. You know, if you get it like at a street fair and it's like not in season, the corn's not good. But this corn was insanely sweet and really good. And Soph had never had that either. So their food was really great too. So I was like, wow, we're really like, you know, that's two for two. I mean, this is amazing. Two amazing meals in a row. And it was so good that when we had to fly home, we had to drive back to Phoenix to drop off the rental car. And we stopped there and ate there again. They have a second location in Tempe. So I feel like she got a really good sense of that kind of food and what that whole kind of the food based on masa on that ground corn was all about. So that was good. And they were amazing. So we're going to take a quick break so I can do something about my voice. And when we come back, I'm going to talk more about those. Listening to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Erica Weitz. So anyway, I was talking about these tacos that I ate in Arizona, and I've been kind of on this taco bender for a while now. You know, like you could go on benders for things that are a lot worse for you than tacos, I think. About, I would say, I don't know, 5-6 weeks ago, I was walking around in Manhattan, and I was in Union Square, where I often am, and there was a taco truck parked there. And they were selling goat tacos. I think I talked about this a few weeks ago. I talked about goat. And I said, ooh, I got to get one of those because I really wanted some goat. And that was like the gateway drug, the goat taco. Like once I ate that, I couldn't stop. It started the bender. And so I sort of had like tacos on my mind because I can't get enough of those soft tortillas. And so then like a week or two later, I was coming out here to Roberta's to do my show, and I got off the L train at Morgan Avenue, and there was a Mexi-Q truck parked right out in front. And I said, oh, Mexi-Q, I want more tacos. And they had roasted wild mushrooms and sweet corn tacos. tacos. I don't know where they were getting the corn. It wasn't in season yet. I hope it wasn't frozen corn. But anyway, theirs were really pretty good too. And then the weird thing was that same night I was hanging out with Alice and Carmen, Heritage Radio Network's own Alice and Carmen from We Dig Plants, who I'm friends with. And somehow we wound up at the Oaxaca Taqueria in Park Slope, where we seem to wind up every time we go out, because usually we go out, we have a few drinks, somebody gets hungry, and we wind up there. So it's kind of been this, like, the theme of the summer has been the soft taco theme, which came to a rousing symphonic conclusion in, well, hopefully not conclusion, in Arizona last week. So anyway, so Soph and I were out there, and we were eating our tacos and our sweet corn, and I like to sort of quiz her on food, because she knows a lot, and I asked her if she knew the difference between sweet corn, you know, corn on the cob, which she's always known, and the corn used to make the tortillas, which is ground field corn. And of course she didn't. I didn't expect her to know that. She's only 11. She's from New Jersey, you know. So I started explaining the whole thing to her about, and yet again, she sort of pretended to be interested, about how Native Americans and the people of Central and South America for thousands and thousands of years have eaten a diet based on corn. That's been their staple, but not sweet corn. Sweet corn actually was a genetic mutation of field corn that popped up in the 1700s. But the corn that's used for tortillas and tamales and things like that is corn that's called field corn or dent corn, and it's not sweet, and it has a much bigger kernel on it, and it's corn that's left to dry out in the field, and when it dries out, it develops a little dent. That's why it's called dent corn. And then once it's dried, it's harvested and taken off the cob. So, you know, unlike sweet corn, which is picked in what's called its milky phase when it's fresh. So field corn has been like this staple food, like I said, since, you know, ancient Mesoamerica, you know, 1300, 1500 BC is like some of the earliest evidence of it being eaten. But if you just pick this stuff dry and grind it up and eat it, and that's your staple diet, mm-hmm. which means that, like, you don't eat much of anything else, you'll very quickly succumb to malnutrition because you'll get a disease called pellagra. You might have heard of pellagra. Because this corn has something on it called the pericarp, which is like a coating. It's like an outer fibrous coating, like a bran. And the pericarp prevents you, as a human, when you eat this corn, from absorbing niacin, which is one of the B vitamins. It's a B3. And so if you eat this, you know, staple subsistence diet of corn, you get pellagra. Unless you're given the magic information from the ancient Mesoamerican gods, which is the only way I can imagine they figured this out, which is that if you take this corn and you do something called nixtamalization to it, you make that niacin nutritionally available to you as a human. Now, the nixtamalization process involves combining the corn with calcium hydroxide. Calcium hydroxide. Or with lime. Not lime the fruit, although that tastes good with corn. Lime from limestone. And so these people figured out thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago that if they ground the corn with limestone tools, or they took powdered lime and mixed it with their corn, or they cooked it with wood ashes, all of which have calcium hydroxide, they would loosen and dissolve that pericarp, which could then be sort of rubbed off. And then the corn was a nutritious staple food that allowed them to build their massive cities of gold and huge empires in Central and South America that thrived for millennia until the Spanish came along and took it all away. So how did they figure that out? I do not know. Do you think that, like, one family ground their corn with limestone and one family ground their corn with something else and they realized, like, hey, those guys are a lot healthier than us. We have pellagra. We're getting these terrible open sores festering all over our bodies and dying. I don't know. But they also figured out that if they ate beans with the corn, the beans provided the amino acids that were missing from the corn to give them this complete protein diet, and they thrived. Right? You sometimes hear about the three sisters in Native American foods and Native American farming. The three sisters of corn, beans, and squash. And if you eat those three things together, you don't really need anything else. That's what I'm talking about. So as the cultivation of corn or maize spread from Mesoamerica up into North America, the process of nixtamalization went along with it. And the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Mexicans all adapted the process, and they still use it in their processing of corn for food. I was in Belize a couple years ago, and I went to visit a lady who was making tortillas. She was going to teach me how. And she had her big bag of ground corn, and then she had a bag of like white stuff, and that was her calcium hydroxide. And I said, oh, what's that? And she said, oh, it's lime. And she threw a powder, you know, a handful of it in with the corn. It's sold under the brand name of Cal, calcium hydroxide, Cal. So if you're going to base your diet on corn, you need to be friends with Cal, because Cal will allow you to not suffer from malnutrition. So I think it's just amazing that they figured it out. I mean, was it like just years and years of trial and error? Was it just divine intervention? I mean, who knows? There are so many things like that with food where you think, like, how did people ever figure this out? I do not know. It also happens in places like in Asia where people eat rice as their staple food. You're really, really poor and all you eat is rice. If it's white rice, if the bran has actually been polished off of the rice, then you wind up with a vitamin deficiency of thiamine, and you get a disease called beriberi, which sounds like a delicious breakfast cereal, beriberi, but it's not. It's actually a horrible disease. And that's sort of the opposite. That's like if you polish your rice because you want white rice and all you eat is white rice, then you get the beriberi. If you didn't polish the rice, in this case, you'd actually be better off. And so when the Spanish conquistadors came to rape and plunder and pillage and steal the cities of gold and destroy the civilizations, they saw that these people had built these amazing places on this diet of corn. And they said, hey, we got to get in on that. And so they took the corn with them back to Europe, where it spread throughout parts of Europe. And people started making corn their staple grain. But what they didn't do is take that technology back to Europe with them. And so people started making corn their staple grain. And after about 100 years, people figured out, hey, if we're only eating this corn, that's why everybody's getting really sick and has horrible skin lesions and eventually is dying of malnutrition if they weren't eating anything else with the corn. And if you're poor enough, like I said, you just eat those grains. And so the joke was kind of on them, those conquistadors, because they may have stolen all the gold and introduced their language and their diseases and their horses and changed the course of history. But in the end, they all got pellagra. So there's history for you. Comes back to bite you in the ass sometimes. Anyway, we're going to take another very quick break. And when we come back, more about corn.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. Remember that you can always find all the Heritage Radio Network shows on iTunes. You can podcast any of them. They're all there. whenever you want them. And you can become a friend of Why We Cook on Facebook. Just find us on there. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Chef Smarty Pants. I don't tweet a lot. I only tweet when it's important. I believe in being judicious with your tweets. Tweets are not something to be tossed around casually. Only tweet if you have something to say. Okay? Anyway, so we're talking about this corn business with pellagra, nixtamalization, calcium hydroxide, this stuff called Cal. And when I was reading about this today, what really astounded me was that as this corn meal product sort of made its way into North America, it made its way very heavily into the rural south of the U.S., where people adapted it as their staple food, cornmeal and cornbread and stuff like that. But yet again, they were not using the process of nixtamalization, because then, you know, the white settlers came to the U.S. and said, oh, yeah, let's cook all this. Let's use this corn. They also did not adapt the technology because they thought, well, we can do things better than those backward native and Mesoamericans. And what happened? Massive pellagra issues that went well up into the 20th century. There were people getting pellagra in the 1950s. Now, it didn't happen if you were eating other things with the corn. You know, if you ate the cornmeal, but you were wealthy enough that you could eat other things, you know, some beans, vegetables, some meat, you were okay. But if you were dirt poor in the rural South and you basically ate cornmeal every day, pellagra, until the 50s. Meanwhile, you know, 1500 years before Christ or whoever, people were doing this in, you know, what is now Guatemala. So I don't know. It's kind of crazy. But anyway, so Soph and I were at the Grand Canyon, like I said. We had a great time. The food there is horrible, by the way. I mean, seriously bad. It's like one of the most significant natural wonders of the world. Why does the food have to be so bad? I don't understand. And then our friend Patty, who we were visiting, wanted to do something really special with us, which was take us to visit some friends of hers who are Hopi and live on the Hopi Reservation in Northern Arizona. And this was a pretty special thing because she was taking us to a place where they have traditional Hopi dances on Saturdays, Kachina dances. And they're not really the ones like for tourists. They're not really open to outsiders. This is like for the people on the reservation and their friends and family. But because Patty's friends with them, we're able to go. So we drove about 3 hours outside of Flagstaff and went to her friend's house. And then we drove another hour with her friend, who's a lady, Marion, who's probably almost 80, and her granddaughter, to another village where they were holding the dances. And the dances are held on this sort of little village square, and people sit in chairs all around, but also everybody goes up on the roof around and looks down. And so we went up on the roof, and it was very hot. I sort of felt like I was on a pizza stone, but it's okay. And these guys come out, and they're dressed in their traditional Kachina costumes with these amazing head things on, like full head masks. I don't know how they didn't pass out from the heat. And they dance, and everybody comes and watches, and it's like this really amazing social activity. Everyone comes out on Saturday and sits around the town square, and it's sort of like this big party, and everybody watches the dances. And I heard people saying, oh yeah, I just came in today to watch the dance from wherever. And it's a really interesting kind of cultural phenomenon that these, you know, very old traditional dances are still held every Saturday, and it becomes like what the town does in this era of things like, you know, Twitter and satellite TV. It's funny because we went to her friend's house and all her little grandchildren were there, and they were all watching SpongeBob on their TV. And then we got in the car and went to watch these dances that are hundreds and hundreds of years old. So, you know, some of the old stuff is being kept alive. So that was pretty interesting. And the people in the, so everybody then like takes a break and everybody eats lunch. They feed the dancers, you know, all the women cook food and they bring it down. They feed the dancers and then everybody eats lunch. And so Marion's friends invited her to lunch and she said, well, I'm with my friends, the three of us. And their friends said, well, you can eat with us, which I thought was incredibly generous that we were invited into their house. We all sat down, we had lunch, and I know this is because of rural poverty and the institutionalized poverty of Native Americans in the U.S., but I have to say, I walked into their house and I saw gigantic boxes of cereal, like Costco-sized boxes of cereal on the shelf, and we were eating KFC for lunch, along with some kind of, you know, bready, white floury type baked stuff and stuff like that. And I don't want to be critical. I don't want to sound like I'm being judgmental or critical, because I really was overwhelmed by the generosity. We were invited into their house. But I thought, here we are in this sort of land where people have lived for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and we're eating KFC. But I also know that there's been a huge drought there for the last 100 years or so, and they can't farm anymore, and they can't really grow any of their traditional stuff, so they're kind of screwed from both ends there. But anyway, it was just, it was an interesting situation. It sort of made me sad. And anyway, but it was a really kind of great experience. And I'm just about out of time here, but I do want to say that then I came home and then I went to Ohio to do the Food and Wine Festival to support Veggie U in Ohio, which I do every year. And my partner Beej and I had decided, you know, months ago that what we were going to do was, yes, a taco. We did a goat taco. We did sort of a Moroccan spiced goat taco with lots of different vegetables from the farm, from the chef's garden. Different heirloom carrot slaw and little pickled cauliflower and all kinds of great vegetables on top. And it was great. Our little taco was a huge hit. And so we're doing the event. There's like 1,200 guests. People are walking around. And this lady came up. She ate one of our tacos. She loved it. And we made them really tiny. We punched the tortillas out into little circles, like two and a half inch circles. So they were little bite-sized ones. And then she came back again, and she had another one. And she said, oh, these are so great. I really love them. And we said, oh, great. We're so happy. And she goes, yeah. And I'm going to Spain next week. And I'm so excited because when I go to Spain, I'm going to be able to eat all the burritos and tacos that I want. And I didn't really have the heart to tell her that in Spain there are no burritos and tacos. But maybe when she goes to Spain, she'll eat a lot of that corn that's been untreated and she'll get pellagra. And that'll teach her, you know, to not know her culinary culture. Anyway, we're out of time. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. AMP goes local. The Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, commonly known as the AMP, that grocery chain you've seen all your life, has glommed onto the concept of local and sustainable and has just introduced a new consortium of producers known as the Mid-Atlantic Country Farms, from which they will source beef and poultry. The animals are antibiotic and hormone-free, raised on vegetarian feed. There is no mention of certified humane or animal welfare approved status, however. Maybe they haven't gotten that far in the marketing department. But what makes this of interest is that AMP supplies all AMP supermarkets, Pathmark, Food Emporium, Waldbaum's, and Super Fresh. These are not particularly high-end supermarkets, so this is good news for the average consumer. If you want to read more about this, you can go to the AMP website, which is www.apt.com/pressroom. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Finger on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexi-Q, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Computer Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery would like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.
July 23rd, Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street. Free pizza by Roberta. Death Killer Death Wrestling. Featuring the legendary Mad Dog Tosto. Photo booth by Ryan Slack. Waterworld. Closed by Chimera Dactyl. Mary Meyer. Warren Bogart. Death Killer Asphalt Resistant Jeans. All types of food for your face. Sweet soda by P&A. Roberta's Bake Sale. Heritage Foods USA. Orange Chaney Eating Contest by the Orange Chaney Brothers. Live music by Alex Trujan. Florida Paper Twin. Dang Sign. The Netherlands. Team Robespierre. Wild Yak. MC Todd and Bo Breezy. Night Show. Yeah. Sponsored by Martin Greenfield Clothers. Free Fitness Studio. Heritage Radio Network. Free Williamsburg. 6 Point Beer. Momo's Sushi Shack. Beer Box USA. Planet of the Bates. Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street.
All day long.